This is NASCAR driver Tony Breininger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books in Intellectual History. I'm your host, Yorgos Giannakopoulos. Today, I'm very happy to be joined by Annelien Dedin. Annelien is a professor of political history at Utrecht University and the author of Freedom, an Unruly History, out with Harvard University Press. Annelien, thanks for joining the program.
Thank you much for having me.
And I'd like to begin this by asking you to share with us what brought you to this particular project.
Well, that's a great question. So I'm European, I'm Belgian more specifically, but a couple of years ago, I lived in the US. I was doing a postdoc there, and this was around the time when Barack Obama had just been elected. And so he and the Democrats were trying to introduce Obamacare in the United States. But I don't know if you remember this, but there was a huge outcry against that attempt, specifically against this idea that there should be an individual mandate related to healthcare. And that whole project was really attacked quite ferociously under the slogan of freedom. So the attempt to to expand healthcare to millions of Americans was depicted by Republicans and other opponents of this project as a terrible attack on freedom. So, and I find that really surprising and interesting. And that got me wondering, where does this, to me at least, quite peculiar idea of freedom come from? So where does this idea that any type of state intervention, even state interventions that, are demonstrably beneficial for millions of people, that those constitute an attack on freedom. So that sort of got me going. Then it got a little bit out of hand, and I ended up working for 7 years on this project, which eventually evolved into a history of freedom from ancient Greece to the present.
In the book, you marvelously bring together the American context and also the European context. So quite aptly, your experience as a European in America certainly shows in the book's narrative arc. Before we go into breaking down various bits of your narrative, I'd like to focus on what you claim to be your main intervention in the debate about freedom. Another way of asking this is, why do you think we need another book about freedom and its history?
Yes, that's another great question to which I have a really simple answer, and that is that currently we simply don't have a history of freedom. In particular, a long durée history of freedom. So obviously, there's a very rich historiography of freedom, but most historians who've worked on the subject so far have focused on individual authors. I'm thinking here of Quentin Skinner's major book on Hobbes, or on national traditions like Eric Foner's book on freedom in the American context. So the only attempt to write a long-term, or the only fairly recent attempt to write a long-term history of freedom that I can think of is Orlando Pedersen's Freedom in the Making of Western History. And that was supposed to go, like my book ended up doing, from ancient Greece to the present. But Pedersen, for some reason, I don't know why, gave up somewhere in the middle of his project. So he only published the first volume going up to the Middle Ages, and the second volume to that history never materialized. Now, once I realized that, I started thinking that this is in a way really bizarre and unfortunate, because freedom is really one of the key political concepts in contemporary political debate. But it means very different things to different people, and those different meanings have a very different history. So that's what I aim to explain in my book. Perhaps this is also a good moment to clarify that my book really focuses on the history of freedom as a political concept. I examine changing answers to the question, what does it mean to be free in a society or as a society? And obviously, there's other questions you may want to ask if you're interested in freedom. For instance, there's a long debate on the history of freedom as an antonym of slavery, so called freedom as a legal category. And then you might also be interested in what I would call moral freedom. So changing answers to the question, what does it mean to be free? Is it even possible to call human beings free? Or are we determined by sort of external forces, such as, for instance, God or biological natures? So those are sort of questions I don't address in my book. My book really focuses on the history of freedom as a political concept.
You're an intellectual historian, and you're providing a very rich picture of thinkers operating across time and space. Thinkers that, as you mentioned, belong to the so-called Western tradition of political thought. I was wondering whether you have any thoughts about thinking about freedom in non-Western forms of political thought, or if that matters at all for the reconstruction that you're making in the book.
Yes, indeed. My book is about the place of freedom in Western political thought. But I do not in any way want to suggest that other cultures don't have this history of thinking about freedom. To give you just one, you know, tiny example that I myself find quite fascinating, the Waho, they were an Indonesian seafaring people. In their culture, it appears freedom, anthropologists have discovered, freedom had just as much of a role as it does in so-called Western political thought. In chronicles that we have from the Waho, 18th century chronicles, they talk about how important it is to be free, how important it is that they are free. And they also are quite explicit about what being free means, aka that it means being able to more or less do as you want and not be controlled by outside forces. And that is very fairly similar, I'd say, to that earlier democratic tradition of freedom that I talk about in my book. Then why did I end up talking mostly about Western political thought? Well, that has to do with reasons of my own expertise, but also because as a European, I live in what we call the West, and that's where I see this conception of freedom being used in contemporary political debate in ways that I myself find quite problematic. Now, I'd also like to clarify what I mean by the West. I don't want to suggest that there is something like a Western political tradition that we should think of as being set in stone or as a natural phenomenon or so, like a continent or the sun for that matter. The way that I myself look at this is as a contingent tradition. The reason that Europeans and to a certain extent Americans tend to think of, for instance, the Greeks and the Romans as being, you know, our forebears in this Western political tradition. The reason that happened is quite complicated, but in many ways this is, you know, purely contingent. It could not have happened at all. And at the same time, I'd also argue, and that is also something that I very much try to show in my book, the nature of this Western tradition is deeply contested. But I'd argue that that doesn't make it less real for us today. That's another reason why I wanted to write this book, or why I think it's important that professional historians write these kind of big narratives, because it's important that we attempt to challenge the stories that we tell ourselves about, you know, what the West is and what Western political thought is, because those stories tend to be quite triumphalist and often deeply inaccurate. So I think it's important that we as professional historians try to sort of provide a counterpoint to those textbook triumphalist narratives.
And don't throw away even the idea of having a narrative, simply because a lot of narratives, grand narratives of that sort, were molded in a period where the West had a different connotation.
Exactly. Again, if we professional historians don't attempt to write those kinds of narratives, then, you know, we'll end up forcing people to turn to those 19th century narratives. And I really don't think that that would be a good thing.
Thinking of freedom as a political concept, one of your key claims in the book is that we need to understand the coming together of the concept of democracy and freedom.
Exactly.
What has been missing in the way historians, intellectual historians, have been thinking about the relation between democracy and freedom?
I was really intrigued by this, you know, where does this idea that freedom requires the absence of state intervention, where does that idea come from? And one of the key arguments I ended up developing in the book is that that particular way of thinking about freedom is far more recent than you think. And that really becomes clear if you look at the long history of freedom. So freedom starting, in ancient Greece. Because if you look at the history of freedom from that long-term perspective, what becomes clear is that for centuries, people tended to think about freedom in a very different way. For centuries, freedom didn't necessarily mean, you know, a minimal state, but what it meant was the ability to exercise control over the way you're governed. So for centuries, freedom was almost synonymous with democracy. And what my book then shows is that the switch to this current way of thinking about freedom, freedom as the absence of the state, that is the result not of long-term intellectual developments like the Reformation and the rise of religious tolerance or the rise of market societies, but that instead it was the result of a dramatic rupture with that democratic conception of freedom, a rupture triggered by a conservative backlash against the Atlantic revolutions.
To quote a poignant passage from the book, you claim that the concept of freedom was gradually transformed from being a weapon to fight for democracy into an instrument that could be used to battle against democracy.
Exactly. So what I ended up discovering was that, okay, for centuries, people, when they were fighting for freedom, what they meant by that was they were fighting for greater control, democratic control over their governments. But what then happens at a moment in time when movements started to gain its first successes in the real world, so the Atlantic revolutions, which roiled the Atlantic world at the end of the 18th century, at that exact moment, a backlash emerges. Conservatives start arguing, no, actually, if you want to be free, democratizing your political system won't really help, because what freedom really means is just, it's not about controlling your government, it's about, you know, privately enjoying your goods, your individual goods, your life, your property. And they start making that claim as a way to counter this claim for a greater democratic control over government. What ends up happening is that this concept of freedom, which used to be employed to fight for democracy, from that moment in time starts to be used as a weapon to fight against democracy. Because if freedom really means being left alone by the state, then you don't really need democracy in order to be free, right? On the contrary, and that's an argument conservatives will use over and over again, democracy might pose a threat to freedom. Democratic government, which has the potential for redistribution, might end up harming individual rights and notably the right to property. So you see that argument starts being used. Freedom is really about, you know, minimal government. That starts to be used to explain why we need less democracy if we want to be more free.
Let's stay a bit in the period of the Atlantic revolutions and maybe break it up for our audience who might not be necessarily familiar with these kinds of terms we historians use. So I'd like you to share with us some of your discoveries with regards to thinkers and the way they understand the relationship between democracy and revolution in turbulent times, in times where political order is really waning.
The Atlantic revolutions, which obviously started in North America, immediately, almost immediately, it triggered this huge backlash. What you see is that you could describe as a transatlantic intellectual movement takes shape of thinkers who start, you know, sort of try to counter this democratic movement and start arguing why democracy is really a bad thing. What you see is that they start explicitly redefining this concept of freedom in order to be able to explain why democracy is a bad thing. And one of the most notable thinkers involved in this movement is Edmund Burke. So Burke is somebody who starts saying in response to the French Revolution, look, you know, democracy is a really bad idea. And most notably, it poses a major threat to freedom. In particular, it's sort of the Jacobin version. If we really want to remain free, what we should do is be happy with the system we have in place in Britain, quite oligarchic system, where less than 5% of the adult population was able to vote for the House of Commons. And huge political power was also exercised to quite an extensive degree by an unelected hereditary House of Lords. But in Burke's view, that system is, you know, the embodiment of liberty is almost the perfect sort of way of institutionalizing freedom, precisely because it isn't democratic. And what you see is that this argument is invented by these counter-revolutionary thinkers like Edmund Burke, but then it almost immediately comes to be picked up by a different movement, a movement that isn't counter-revolutionary, so that accepts some of the gains, in particular of the French Revolution, such as, for instance, the separation between church and state, but a movement that is nevertheless also very skeptical of democracy. And that movement is the liberal movement. So there's lots of ways of defining what liberalism is, but in my view, one of the sort of easiest ways identifying what liberalism is, historically speaking, is to simply look at people who self-identified as liberals. And people only started self-identifying as liberals in a political sense in the early 19th century, most notably in France. So that's where, you know, sort of the early liberal movement takes shape. And those early liberals, and I'm thinking here of thinkers such as Benjamin Constant, they in some ways thought of themselves as the heirs of the French Revolution, right? As I just mentioned, one of the revolutionary achievements that they tended to embrace was the separation between church and state. But what makes them very different from the French and also American revolutionaries is that they were extremely skeptical of democracy. And that is sort of a legacy of the terror, obviously. And a result of that skepticism is that liberals throughout the 19th century, in particular in the first half of the 19th century, European liberals tended to embrace and propagate political systems that we would describe as oligarchic. Liberalism, because of its fear of democracy, a fear instilled by the French, by the derailment of the French Revolution into the terror, becomes an anti-democratic movement. And that sort of encourages liberals to adopt this counter-revolutionary claim that the best way to protect freedom is to curb democracy. Benjamin Constant here is a great example. So one of his most famous essays on liberty, where he develops this idea that modern liberty is about private enjoyment and the protection of individual rights, and where, you know, he sort of rejects this idea that the revolutionary definition of freedom, the identification of freedom with self-government, that is something worthwhile.
At the same time, though, as you mentioned in the book, there are ways of liberal thinking that are closer to democracy. An example that you write in the book is John Stuart Mill and his own understanding of democracy and freedom. So my question here is, how can we understand the differences between liberal thinking and the tensions between democracy and individual rights?
Well, that's a great question. So what you see happening in the second half of the 19th century is that liberals in many European countries, and most notably in France, and to a lesser extent also in the UK, slowly start accepting that the rise of democracy is in fact inevitable. And you see that they start toning down their anti-democratic rhetoric, and that they start, to a certain extent, they start accepting democracy as a legitimate form of government. But what remains similar to the sort of earlier part of the 19th century is that these same liberals continue to argue that even though democracy might be an acceptable form of government, it is not liberty. So if you want to protect liberty, and if you're a liberal, then you should always privilege freedom, the protection of these individual rights, over and above democracy and democratic majoritarianism. And the interesting thing is that you even see that idea cropping up in the writings of somebody like John Stuart Mill. So Mill is, I think, extremely interesting thinker. Well, obviously, I'm not the only person who thinks that, who has a background in a different intellectual tradition, which is radicalism, right? He was a godson of Jeremy Bentham. And one of the things that is Jeremy Bentham was notable for was that he was in the UK one of the earliest proponents of manhood suffrage. Mill, in a way, is even more radical than this heritage because he also embraces the right to suffrage for women. What I try to show in my book is that this is really very much under the influence of French liberal thinkers. At the same time, you see that Mills also comes to really insist on this idea that freedom isn't democracy and that protecting freedom doesn't necessarily mean that you need to expand democracy. On the contrary, somebody like Mill harps on this idea that what we should be really worried about is a tyranny of the majority. And of course, on the face of it, that is a legitimate worry. I would be the last person to deny that, you know, tyranny of the majority is something we should be worried about. But what I find interesting is that Mill is sort of harping on this idea in intellectual context where the overwhelming majority of the British population did not have a vote. So he's insisting that we should be worrying about majoritarian tyranny at the very same time when, you know, the fight for democracy was still very much ongoing in the British context. And I find, in that sense, I find the contrast with his godfather, Bentham, quite intriguing, right? Bentham was worried about what he was worried about was what he called sinister interests, the oligarchic control of British elites over British political life. That's what Bentham was most worried about in the later period of his life. And I would say that if you look at the context in which those two thinkers were living, I'd say that Bentham had more reason to say that we should be worrying about the influence of sinister interests than somebody like Mill had for saying that we should be worrying about the tyranny of the majority. And that brings me to a larger point, and that is that one of the things that I try to show in my book is that this fear for majoritarian tyranny, which again, on the face of it, isn't, you know, that's not a crazy, you know, thing to worry about. It's a legitimate worry that we have. But if you look at the history of freedom, what you see is that this idea starts to be mobilized, instrumentalized by a series of conservative movements, counter-revolutionary movements, anti-democratic movements, in order to fight against democracy. So what I find interesting is that you have this, you know, abstract discussion about, democratic theory and the danger of majoritarianism. But what we should be paying more attention to is how this idea was mobilized in time to fight for, the interests of elites rather than for the interests of vulnerable minorities.
This creates a heritage and a tradition that influences even the most radical of liberals, at least in the British context, John Stuart Mill, right?
Yes, exactly. I'd say that this is something that you still see, you know, influencing liberals to this very day.
Moving on towards the end of the latter part of the 19th century and on towards the 20th century, in the book, you talk about the rise of collectivism and collectivist thought, and you have something to say about how this influenced the evolution, the ever-evolving understanding of liberalism as an ideology and the relation to democracy. What is it that you find interesting as we move on towards the 20th century in the way this counter-revolutionary tradition is being influencing different strata of thought?
You have the emergence of this counter-revolutionary conservative way of thinking about freedom. Freedom is not democracy. It's just, you know, having your individual rights protected, and democracy potentially poses a threat to this. Hence, protecting freedom means curbing democracy. So that idea starts you know, that emerges in this counter-revolutionary context and then comes to be picked up by liberal thinkers in the course of the 19th century. So that idea gets huge airplay, so to speak, in the course of the 19th century. In particular, as in a European context, at least, various attempts to further democracy or to democratize through revolution, such as the revolutionary wave of the 1840s. So what you see is that idea, you know, gains energy, that counter-revolutionary conception of freedom, that you know, gets new energy from every other failure of revolutionary attempts to introduce democracy in Europe. That just really stimulates this idea that freedom is potentially threatened by democracy. But then by the end of the 19th century, that fear is even further amplified by a second new development, and that is the very early attempts to use the state to redistribute wealth from the very rich to the poor, and to create something that starts to look like a welfare state. Again, really leads to a new resurgence of this idea that freedom is really threatened by democracy. And what you then see is that somebody, a thinker like Herbert Spencer, starts, you know, producing lots of books and articles arguing that socialism is slavery. But what he really means isn't Marxist socialism, of course. What he really means, what he feels threatened by, are attempts, you know, to our mind at least, are fairly obviously necessary, attempts to regulate conditions, working conditions, to prohibit child labor, etc. So to Spencer, all of that is socialism, and all of that is, a major threat to freedom. In addition to sort of the emergence of democracy, itself, revolutionary attempts to introduce democracy. By the end of the 19th century, this conservative fear of democracy, a fear that is articulated in the language of liberty, gets new oxygen from the rise of socialism and of early attempts to use state power in the interests of poor people.
Another key moment that you trace towards the end of the book, obviously, concerns the Cold War moment and the redefinitions of liberty and democracy there. And I guess this is a moment much closer to the present. So I'm wondering, if we were to turn to that particular period in time, you refer to thinkers like Berlin and Hayek and others, what would be the key pointers in the way that this distancing between democracy and liberty takes place?
As I mentioned earlier, what I'm trying to figure out in this book is, how did this idea that freedom is threatened by state intervention and that a free state is therefore a minimal state, how did that idea manage to get the sort of enormous hold on political debate that it has today? One big explanation is that counter-revolutionary backlash against democracy in the first place and socialism in the second place, that then leads to attempts to redefine freedom as something that is very different from democracy and potentially under threat from democracy. But there's also a second storyline here, and that is the storyline of how the left then gave up on the concept of freedom. And that doesn't happen right away. So initially, when counter-revolutionaries and classical liberals start redefining freedom in order to argue, you know, we don't need democracy in order to be free. All you need to be free, you know, is a state that leaves you alone. That argument is continues to be disputed by left-wing political movements. In the first place, by movements that continue to fight for greater democracy, such as the radical Republican movement in various European countries, or the feminist movement in Britain and in the United States, as well as the abolitionist movement and the movement for civil rights. So obviously none of these movements agree with this counter-revolutionary idea that being free just means being left alone by the state, right? They continue this revolutionary tradition that freedom is about democracy. But what you then see happening at the same time is that by the end of the 19th century, a number of new movements emerge. Some of these movements call themselves socialist, but others prefer, you know, other denominations. In France, for instance, you have a really interesting political party that calls itself the radical socialists, so they place themselves deliberately in that radical tradition rather than the Marxist socialist tradition, as well as the sort of new liberalism of the late 19th century in Britain, for instance. And what you see is that those movements start placing themselves in that revolutionary tradition. But what their sort of argument is that we shouldn't just try to expand, we shouldn't just try to gain greater control over our political lives if we want to be free. We also need to gain greater control over our economic lives. So there's this really great quote by Jean Jaurès, the French socialist leader, who writes a famous history of the French Revolution, where he writes something along the lines of, well, the French Revolution, the goal of the French Revolution was to liberate us by introducing political democracy. The goal of socialism is to complete that revolution by also expanding democracy to the economic sphere. So the left, up until the 1950s, I would argue, presents itself as the heirs of that revolutionary, democratic, freedom-centric tradition. But then with the emergence of the Cold War, so in the 1950s, then something happens that sort of puts an end to that embrace of freedom by these left-wing movements. And the way I explain what happens in the book is that in the wake of the Cold War, the left also ends up embracing the concept of freedom that was invented by these counter-revolutionaries and that has become associated with individuals, classical liberals like Herbert Spencer, laissez-faire liberalism. Mm-hmm. And I think the best example of a thinker where we see that happening is Isaiah Berlin. So as we all know, Isaiah Berlin, one of the sort of great theorists of freedom of the 20th century, was not a neoliberal, right? He was not a classical liberal. He was not a laissez-faire liberal. On the contrary, we know that he voted Labour at least a couple of times. And we also know that he was in favor of Roosevelt's New Deal. But at the same time, Berlin is adamant that we should, so he thinks we should be using state power. There's nothing wrong with that. So what you see is that in the case of somebody like Isaiah Berlin, is that even though he embraces the idea that the state should provide greater economic security to ordinary individuals, he's adamant that we shouldn't describe that in terms of liberty. So he embraces this conception of freedom as an absence of state intervention.
Having read the book, I think one also is left with the impression that, these kinds of conceptualizations that you just mentioned are winning the debate today. So if the left has given up on the concept of freedom, how can we regain this very rich relation that over the years, over the centuries, and given the influence of the counter-revolutionary tradition has waned? Do you see in contemporary political theory any attempts to fruitfully reconceptualize and bring back democracy into understandings of freedom?
Yes. I think there's two interesting developments to point out in this regard. One development is the sort of embrace of or the emergence in political theory of a new kind of political theory, namely neo-republicanism. So today, contemporary political philosophers like Philip Pettit, for instance, he's a prominent philosopher today who makes these kinds of arguments, have started arguing, and they're drawing on the work of intellectual historians like Quentin Skinner, whose work I myself also have drawn on quite extensively, to sort of argue that we should be reaching back to this older conception of freedom, this more, what I call more democratic conception of freedom, although Pettit, for various reasons, prefers to call it a republican conception of freedom. So you really see, in political philosophy, you really see that there's an attempt to rethink current notions of freedom and to sort of break through this by now increasingly unsatisfactory dichotomy that Berlin introduced into political theory between negative freedom as freedom in the absence of state interference on the one hand and positive freedom. State intervention does enhance your freedom if certain conditions are fulfilled, by reminding us that it's not, you know, the question is not whether the state can or cannot enhance our freedom. Question is what kind of state allows us to live as free people. So in political theory, I think, you know, you really see an attempt to rekindle these older conception of freedom. And that is something that I also hope to contribute to with my own book. But then another development that I find equally interesting is that you see that left-leaning politicians, in particular in the US, and I'm thinking of somebody like Bernie Sanders here, are also increasingly starting to make the case that the state, if it is a democratic state, can be used to enhance people's freedom instead of always acting as an infringement of our liberty. And that is another reason why I felt it was necessary to write this book right now, to provide a sort of a back history to those attempts and to show that Sanders is actually right. There is a long, rich tradition of left-leaning thinking about freedom, you know, of left-wing politicians, socialist politicians identifying themselves as the, you know, heirs of freedom, of freedom-centric traditions like the Atlantic Revolutionary tradition.
Annelien, thank you very much for this discussion.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be here.